Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Today, we'll mark the 137th run for the Roses. Ahead in Only a Game, Jenny Reese picks the Derby ponies with unfailing accuracy. Also, NBA playoff basketball takes hold in Oklahoma City and Memphis. Nashvillians fall prey to the NHL's Predators and a ripping spin around Ferrari World Abu Dhabi. Also ahead, a conversation with New York Jets head coach Rex Ryan, who takes pride in needling NFL star quarterbacks and in keeping the family trade alive.
I think the big reason I really wanted to be a coach was because I would see my dad. He would go to work, and he literally could not wait to get to work. He loved his job.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Last night in Dallas, the Mavericks took advantage of several late turnovers and defensive lapses by Los Angeles to beat the Lakers 98-92. The Mavericks are up 3-0 in that series, and they can close it out tomorrow. In other NBA action, the Chicago Bulls grounded the Atlanta Hawks 99-82. The Bulls lead that series 2-1. Today in Boston, the Miami Heat will attempt to put the Celtics in an 0-3 hole, and in Memphis, the Oklahoma City Thunder will try to take a 2-1 lead in their series with the Grizzlies. Joining me now on the line is Barry Trammell, sports columnist for the Oklahoman and NewsOK.com. Barry, welcome to Only a Game.
How you doing, Bill?
Very well, thank you. Oklahoma City ended the regular season with the fourth-best record in the West. They dispatched fifth-seed Denver fairly easily in the first round. Did the Thunder underestimate Memphis, the eighth seed, going into the second round?
The standard line is no, but the evidence may be yes, because if you look at the way the Thunder played in Game 2, it was much improved over Game 1. They're not the old Grizzlies, so you got to come ready to play.
This is not your grandfather's Grizzlies.
Or even your Grizzlies of 15 minutes ago. Somebody asked me, is Memphis fans are going to need a program to tell their own players? And I think the answer is yes. They've sold out more games in the playoffs already than they did during the regular season.
The Thunder have been in Oklahoma City for just 3 years. When the team was the Seattle Supersonics, they struggled in the standings and at the gate. To what do you attribute the team's appeal and recent success?
Oklahoma City has embraced the NBA. Going back to 2005, when Oklahoma City got the Hornets temporarily in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, and then after one dark season, the Sonics moved here with a horrible team, but the city just embraced the concept of NBA basketball. The four leading scorers are 22 or younger. The future is bright, so everybody's going crazy over the NBA.
Kevin Durant is the face of the franchise. Tell us a little bit about some of the other players we should be paying attention to as the series progresses.
Well, most people know about Russell Westbrook, just an incredibly athletic point guard. Serge Ibaka is a 21-year-old power forward from the Congo who didn't play basketball until he's 16. James Harden is the scorer off the bench, known mostly for his full beard, one of the best beards in the NBA. Kendrick Perkins, who's traded to Oklahoma City in February, broke New England hearts. This was really a team that had virtually every piece except a defensive presence in the middle. And then all of a sudden, here comes Gran Torino himself, Kendrick Perkins. Get off my lawn, stay out of my lane, Kendrick Perkins. And he's just exactly what the Thunder needed.
How are fans behaving now that they have a team capable of advancing to the conference finals or maybe even to the NBA finals?
Smack dab in the middle of college football country. You know, the old story was the favorite sport is football, and the second favorite sport is spring football. But college football still number one, no doubt about it. But the NBA is gaining fast. It's a statewide phenomenon over in Tulsa. The the other big metropolitan area in the state, huge Thunder fans. So it's really taken Oklahoma by storm.
You want to give us your prediction for how this series will go, starting with Game 3 today?
If the Thunder gets a split in Memphis, I think they win in 7.
Barry Trammell is a sports columnist for The Oklahoman and NewsOK.com. Barry, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You bet, Bill.
Even if you think their nickname is inappropriate because of the paucity of bears in Memphis, you have to concede that the Grizzlies have approached the postseason with a requisite ferocity. Here to fill us in on all things Grizzly is Memphis Commercial Appeal columnist Jeff Calkins. Jeff, welcome to Only a Game.
Good to be here. And Grizzly is no more inapt than, say, Laker or Dodger or any number of other nicknames.
Absolutely right. The Grizzlies snuck into the playoffs. They earned the 8th and last spot in the West and then proceeded to knock San Antonio, which posted the NBA's second-best regular season record right out of the postseason. Had you seen that coming?
It's very rare that you have a 1-8 upset, so I hadn't seen that coming. This level of play from the Grizzlies really has been sort of only the back half of this season. So I think that those of us in Memphis who had seen the team lose 12 straight playoff games before thought that this would be the year that they would win one or two, but not a run like this.
The Grizzlies migrated to Memphis from Vancouver 10 years ago, having suffered through 6 dismal seasons north of the border. How was it that no one thought it would be a good idea to find a nickname based on wildlife indigenous to Memphis?
I think it really is the Laker thing, or it could just be parsimony. Why change the stationery? Or there was some sort of discussion, and it was known as an incredibly parsimonious franchise, and they brought the misery of the Great Northwest here. The Grizzlies come here, and last or close to the last in attendance in the league for the better part of 10 years, an owner that has irritated most people in the city. They become the first team ever to lose 12 straight playoff games, be swept from the playoffs 3 straight times. So even when they succeed, they fail. And were hugely overshadowed by the college team in town, the Memphis Tigers. So this is all fairly new to us, this burst of enthusiasm. And it has been, you know, people were starting to wonder how long could they last here. And this is truly this run. What you feel is this sort of community, and that's been the fun part about it.
Give me some specific examples of that burst of enthusiasm you're talking about. Are there flags on the car antennas of people wearing the colors in the street? What do you see?
At one of the games on Saturday, a few weeks back, there were 2 Orthodox Jews who sat right behind me who had walked 11 miles to get to the game. The game ended after sundown so they could drive back, but they strapped water packs to their back and walked 11 miles to get to the game. You know, after they finally did knock out San Antonio to win their first playoff series ever, Shane Battier, who has an apartment in town, and Chris Wallace, who's the general manager of the team, they went walking down Beale Street, high-fiving fans, and that sort of thing happening times 1,000.
You want to give us a prediction on how this series will go, starting with Game 3 today?
In their 2 series here, they have not been down. So I think it's critical for them to win today. By dint of the fact that it's going to be a madhouse once again, I'll give the edge to the Grizzlies. Therefore, I guess I'll give them the edge in the series, too. But I'm on the edge of my seat, honestly.
Jeff Calkins is a columnist for the Memphis Commercial Appeal. He joined us from Memphis. Jeff, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill, for having me. I appreciate it.
Detroit lives. By the score of 4-3, the Red Wings playing at home beat the San Jose Sharks last night to avoid elimination in that NHL series. San Jose now leads the Wings 3-1. Meanwhile, in Boston, the Bruins sent the Philadelphia Flyers into their offseason by scoring 5 goals to Philly's 1. The Bruins will next face the Tampa Bay Lightning in the Eastern Conference Finals. The Vancouver Canucks hold a 3-1 lead in their second-round series with the Nashville Predators, who are in the second round for the first time. Though Nashville may go no further, the long-term viability of this small-market Sun Belt team has never looked stronger. Only a Game's Kim Green has the story.
Sunday night, scores of fans welcomed the Predators home from Vancouver at a private airport terminal in Nashville. The Preds were 1-1 in the series after Game 2. But their marathon double overtime win on Saturday had this underdog team marching home to perhaps soon-to-be conquering heroes. Amid a frenzied media scrum after Monday practice, center Jared Smithson from British Columbia bristles when people ask if Music City could possibly care about hockey.
That's ridiculous, you know. I've been here a little while now and starting to realize, you know, how much the team means to the city. The fans are so passionate. They're behind us 100%, and it really is a great hockey town.
The temperature plunges 20 or 30 degrees as the Canucks sweep into downtown Nashville for Game 3 on Tuesday. A few snowflakes fall on Bridgestone Arena, although they're fake. The house is sold out, and a sea of gold t-shirts and rally towels undulate from floor to ceiling. Nashville feels like a hockey town tonight. And for fans like Cody Holland, a Tennessee native and inmate of a notoriously loud section of seats called Cell Block 303, this trip to round two is a win, no matter what.
Because we're in absolutely uncharted territory, and I think more than anything, we're absolutely enjoying it. Because there's no expectations, there's no stress. We're just going in there and having a great time and watching a hockey game at this point.
J.R. Lind, a sports business reporter for the Nashville Post, says Nashville's finally starting to really embrace its hockey team. Sponsorships are up, and after years of half-empty stands, he says Preds tickets are now actually hard to get.
It's our classic bad teenage movie of, oh, we took her glasses off and let her hair down, and look at how beautiful she is, and now everybody wants to go out with her.
It certainly doesn't hurt that the Preds are winning more. But Lind, who met his wife in Cell Block 303, says there's more to it than that. In 2007, owner Craig Leopold decided to sell. Nashvillians thought they were losing their team, but a group of local businessmen pooled their money and bought the Predators. Lind says the new owners brought in some hockey front office heavyweights who changed the team's marketing approach from stick to carrot.
For the last several years, the season ticket push or the ticket push has been this paranoid buy tickets or your team's going to move to Hamilton.
Instead, they offered discounts and college night specials and even gave away tickets. They started selling enough seats to get NHL revenue sharing money. And the Predators organization, which leases the arena from the city, booked big names like Lady Gaga and Garth Brooks on non-hockey nights to bring in more revenue. That's money they can use to hold on to stars like Shea Weber and Mike Fisher. Although Nashville might not have a long hockey tradition, it's building one. A perfect example is this new guy on the roster.
I'm Blake Jeffram from Brentwood, Tennessee. Play for Nashville Predators and 23 years old, and I'm good looking.
In this locker room, that last bit's par for the course. But the fact that Jeffrion grew up in a Nashville suburb playing hockey in local leagues, that's pretty radical. Jeffrion brings his own long tradition to Nashville. His great-grandfather Howie Morenz and grandfather Bernie Boom Boom Jeffrion are Hall of Famers. His father Dan also played in the NHL. Blake Jeffrion would love to make a run for the Cup and show all those northern types that Nashville's got game.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be huge for the city, huge for the organization, huge for minor league hockey and all the kids here, and just kind of make a statement that you know, the Predators are a good team and are a good organization and prove to them that, you know, Nashville is real.
Even though the Canucks might knock Nashville out of Cup contention tonight, there's a growing buzz about the Predators, and not just in Nashville. J.R. Lind says even the Canadian media has stopped asking how long the team can survive here.
And now when you read and you watch that coverage from Canada, it's this is really becoming a hockey town. And then they start talking about something else. They talk about the crowds or they talk about hockey, which is amazing. That you can get Canadian media to talk about your hockey team.
For Only a Game, I'm Kim Green in Smashville.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Who knows where this may end, possibly more than 5 inches beyond where it began. That's what the organizers of the Long Nose World Championships at Langenbruck, Germany, are hoping. They judge both the length and width of the noses of the contestants, and those judges are tired of seeing the same old long noses. There must be people out there with gigantic noses we just haven't seen, said one judge, who apparently hopes that reigning champion Joseph DeWald with his 5-inch nose will not prevail again. Longshot hopefuls have until the final in June to poke their noses into this competition.
Your big nose in my business. Your big nose in my business. Oh, that's Nosy Joe, the nosiest guy I know.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the fastest ride outside a Ferrari is inside a quasi-Ferrari in Abu Dhabi. But first, a little later on today, the Kentucky Derby will occur for the 137th time. As I prepared earlier this week to discuss the event, utilizing brilliant speed, as if with pants on fire, I dialed in to the Animal Kingdom. Watch me go toward the decisive moment when I will contact Jenny Reese of the Louisville Courier-Journal, I thought, for she will have caught all those silly references to horses originally set to run today. Ms. Reese has picked the winner for each of the past 18 years, right, Jenny?
Absolutely, but I'm disappointed, Bill. You didn't get sold that in your ditty there.
I ran out of time. Before you tell me which horse will win this Derby, I want to talk a little bit about the collective talent, or perhaps absence of same. I've read that this Derby is seriously lacking in fast horses, at least as measured by outspoken handicapper and turf rider Andy Beyer. Are we going to see a boat race?
I think they just don't get the point of the Kentucky Derby. I long have said some derbies are better than others, but there's never a bad derby. And they might be slower than some of the fields in the past, but they're competitively slower. So it's going to make for a great race, and it's going to make for great betting, which Mr. Byers, I would think, would really appreciate.
Is it fair to say that industry-wide, two of the recent stories with legs have been how slow the last couple of derbies have been and how fragile today's thoroughbreds seem to be?
Those have been the overarching themes. Now, I will say the geneticist will tell you when people say how much inferior the breed is now that it just takes hundreds of years really to make a species different. The people that work with these horses every day, they say they can look at their legs and the bone of them just doesn't seem like it has the same density as it used to have. But people far smarter than me will have to sort that out.
Jenny, speaking of fragile, one of the potential favorites, Uncle Mo, was scratched yesterday. Does that change the nature of today's competition?
Only in that some people are unhappy that he came out because they thought, with his reputation, he was the unbeaten two-year-old champion, that he would be heavily bet and it would make the prices on the horses that they liked. They're trying to find out. It's a mystery to them exactly what's wrong with him. They thought it was a GI tract inflammation, and they said, yes, well, he had that. When they took him off the medication, which they had to do before race time, he sort of regressed in his treatment. So they think that there's something related to an enzyme going on there. But anyways, a lot of people thought that if he ran, he was a definite play against.
Master of Hounds was established as a 30-1 shot earlier this week. This horse is raced in England, Ireland, the United Arab Emirates, also once before at Churchill Downs last fall. There's an old racing saying that goes like this, horses for courses. I'm wondering if the owners of Master of Hounds are still looking for the right course for their horse.
I think you're right, and I think they're thinking they found the right company. I think they absolutely think that this is an inferior group of three-year-olds in America, and they have a big shot to come over. We've seen this movie before. you know, they've come over here and done well, but it's when they've brought a champion. And Master of Hounds, even though he has a very great name, love the name, I think he's, you know, one of those horses that you're going to say after the race, gosh, the Irish suckered me in again.
Part of the fun of any horse race is the names of the entries, some of which, of course, I've already mentioned. In this Derby, we've also got Derby Kitten, which sounds about right. We've got Twin Spired, which, you know, invokes the two spires looming over Churchill Downs. And I can see the logic of naming a horse Brilliant Speed or Decisive Moment or even Watch Me Go. They're all on the card. But Arch, Arch, Arch?
Well, his sire is Arch. And the great thing about it, this horse, who won the Arkansas Derby, is if you miss the stallion's name on the first syllable, you got two more to get it right. That's like a triple endorsement all in one name.
Dwayne Lucas, who has trained four Kentucky Derby winners, does not have a horse in today's race, which I'm sure he regrets, speaking of great horses' names. Do you by any chance know which horse he's betting on? Because I'd like to know.
You know what? That is a good question, and I'm kicking myself now that I didn't go by his barn and get his opinion, because he sits here and watches all these horses train, and if you get him in the tack room aside, he'll tell you what he thinks. I will tell you, I have another, what I consider, you know, a backside mole, a longtime trainer whose opinion I really respect, who's watched them all train. The horse he likes, and he's going to be a big price, is Animal Kingdom. Now, this horse has never run on dirt before, but if he would win this, it's a great story because his rider will be John Velasquez, who was supposed to ride Uncle Mo, who, of course, was scratched. John Velasquez picked up the mount on Animal Kingdoms on Friday because Robbie Alvarado, who was supposed to ride the horse, was tossed from his mount in a, before a race Wednesday and broke his nose. Ooh. And had lacerations, and he didn't ride Friday, and they decided to make a change with this horse.
Jenny, I'm wondering if we should throw a wrinkle into the handicapping this year. Would you like to give us three horses our listeners can box, that is, bet to finish first, second, and third in any order so they can make a fortune?
Okay. And this is the way I'm looking at this, that if I'm going to be wrong, I might as well be wrong with a bomber, because if I'm right, everybody, I'll be able to live off it the next 15, 20 years. So I'm going with this horse, Brilliant Speed, who in his first two starts on real dirt, the only times he's ran on real dirt, he lost by a total of 40 lengths. But he looked very good winning the Bluegrass. If he likes the Churchill Downs strip, he's going to be a huge prize. So use him with Arch, Arch, Arch. And then I would also throw in, maybe I better throw in the favorite. Isn't that something? We've gone all this way and we haven't even talked about the favorite Dialed In. It's that kind of year.
Okay. So are you thinking Dialed In is going to be the winner or Brilliant Speed?
Well, again, I'm trying to maximize my fame with this, if I'm right. And so I'm going with Brilliant Speed on top, then Arch, 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 then Dialed In.
Jenny Reese of the Louisville Courier-Journal is 18-0 at picking Kentucky Derby winners for Only a Game, which explains not only my summer place in the Hamptons, but the several Italian automobiles gleaming in the garage beneath the executive sports suite from which I conduct business. And Jenny, despite that explanation, you know, some listeners will email to ask if you have really picked 18 Derby winners in a row.
Well, you outed me by having podcasts.
Thanks, Jenny.
Thank you.
Oh, the sun shines bright on my old Kentucky home. Keep them hard times away from my door.
Tomorrow in Istanbul, Formula One teams representing McLaren, Lotus, and Ferrari, among others, will be vying for the top prize in the Turkish Grand Prix, the fourth of 19 international F1 races this year. Followers of the circuit are known for their devotion to F1 and to its drivers, a few of whom are the most highly paid competitors in the world. But for fans who wish to indulge their passion beyond the grandstand and the concession booth, there's another option. Ferrari World Abu Dhabi, which has as its theme the world's most iconic race car. Only a Game's Ken Shulman visited the United Arab Emirates capital to learn more about Ferrari fever.
There really aren't words for the way your neck seizes up when you rocket from 0 to 150 miles per hour, faster than you can say Michael Schumacher. It's the G-Force Formula One drivers feel when they accelerate, and the G-Force you feel on Formula Rossa, the world's fastest roller coaster, and the marquee attraction at Ferrari World Abu Dhabi. Ferrari World Abu Dhabi is the first theme park in the Persian Gulf, and the only Ferrari park anywhere. The mix of machismo and motors plays well in this neighborhood of broad boulevards, fast cars, and massive oil reserves. This isn't Paris thumbing its collective nose at Mickey Mouse. Actually, Ferrari World is its own neighborhood. The park's sinuous steel and glass roof furls over an area larger than 15 football fields, sheltering rides, exhibits, restaurants, and a movie theater. But it's not just the locals who succumb to its high-octane Italian charm. The largest indoor theme park on the planet has drawn visitors from India, South Africa, France, and scores of other countries since it opened last November. Abdul Akhmatov flew 10 hours from Kyrgyzstan to buy a hat and keychain and ride Formula Rossa. He's flying home tomorrow.
I expected, you know, that a little bit more speed than we can feel on the car itself. But it's more than more. 240 kilometers per hour were done within like 1.5 seconds only. So it's amazing and very scary as well.
Do you love cars?
Yes, sure, especially Ferrari.
What's so great about Ferrari?
Speed, of course. Speed and design.
Formula One racing isn't like baseball or soccer. Most fans can buy a ball or glove, but very few people can afford a Ferrari. Fewer still have the $250 million you need to keep a car on the Formula One circuit for a single season. What is it then about this sport and this car that sings to folks tied up in traffic from Delhi to Dakar? Russell Laughlin is marketing manager at the Yas Hotel, Ferrari World's neighbor on Abu Dhabi's Yas Island. The futuristic five-star resort straddles Abu Dhabi's Formula One racetrack. On race day, cars whip beneath, around, and through it. But the Grand Prix visits Abu Dhabi just once a year. Ferrari World is open every day.
Oh, Ferrari World is huge. It's a huge attraction for Yas Island. And the Yas Hotel has done very well from its affiliation. We work very closely. Quite simply, Ferrari World is a super wow.
Why do people like racing cars so much?
Oh, I think it's all us wannabes. We want to drive fast sometimes. It's the romance, it's the excitement, the speed, and all those things that go connected with that. There's maybe even a slight element of danger.
Speed, design, danger. It's a potent cocktail, but there's a missing ingredient, desire. Francesco Cordonetto is a psychologist from Rome. He thinks race cars, and Ferrari in particular, tickles something in the corners of our collective memory.
Ferrari is a symbol of power, an object of desire, something we need to possess in order to attain status and prestige. For the people of the Persian Gulf, it's the affirmation of the power of money, as if that money, which comes from their oil, took form and shape in this car. As an Italian, I'm proud this park highlights my country's creative genius, but I'd be happier if the money spent to build Ferrari World had gone to help some depressed country in the third world.
Sarebbe stato meglio. Thank you very much this way. Enjoy your ride. Thank you.
Except for the trademark color, no one will ever confuse Ferrari World with the Red Cross. But the majority of the park's 900 employees do come from depressed third world countries. Men from Kolkata, India make tortellini at Rosticceria Modena, where modest Gulf women shrouded in black share pizza on red and white checkered tablecloths. The Magic Motor Kingdom makes strange bedfellows beneath the even stranger grace of Ferrari. Nevermind Lucky works the gate at Formula Rossa. For the 22-year-old Zimbabwean, Ferrari isn't just a job, it's a vocation. And yes, his name is Nevermind.
Do you love Ferrari?
I love Ferrari too much.
Why?
Because it's giving me an experience that is out of this world. I love Ferrari. And wherever I will go, I will tell the people the experience I got in Ferrari World. It will be in my rest of my life, and I will keep it.
An exit through the gift shop confirms Ferrari as racing's number one brand. What other stable has its own line of wallets, watches, and bathrobes? But at Ferrari World, the brand takes on the trappings of faith. Roadsters suspended in space like airborne icons. A pristine pilgrimage through a miniature Italian landscape. Or this 3D virtual tour of the hallowed factory in Maranello. Not recommended, by the way, to those who suffer from motion sickness. Where you can witness the conception and miracle birth of yet another Ferrari. It's also very seductive, and also very Twilight Zone. The hypnotic lights, the endless music loops, the movie theater that shows the same Italian racing feature over and over and over again.
Very happy.
We are
and company our giving
out
is
of this world experience.
Out of this world experience. Exciting.
You even get the same comment from every worker you talk to. Well, I suppose you can't fault them. Any more than you can fault Happy, Dopey, and Doc for whistling while they work. Or any more than you can fault the customers here for chasing their 800-horsepower Italian dreams at $100 a pop. Because that's what this park is for them. Not a religion, not a brand. It's just a dream come true. For Only a Game, I'm Ken Schulman.
You're listening to Only a Game. Last week's show featured a story by Maria Bakalopoulou about the songs fans sing during soccer games between Celtic and Rangers in Scotland and the attempt to ban some of those songs. Kyle Darcy, who was raised in Belfast, Northern Ireland, appreciated the reminder of the soundtrack that accompanies those games. The story was right on target, and it brought back memories of my youth. He wrote, "Well done." In connection with that story based in Scotland, Jeffrey McComb emailed to say, "I should have said Glasgow, not Glasgow," and he also wrote that Scots say Glasgow. George Espy, who lives in Montville, Pennsylvania, found himself thinking about the $9 billion over which the NFL and the league's players have been arguing. It would be wonderful if they would not be so greedy and would donate all the money to the states and municipalities, considering the condition they are in. Mr. Espy wrote, "I don't live in a city that would benefit from such a gift, but I'm sure it would be accepted by those who have supported the teams and players." Jeffrey Goldwasser, a rabbi in Williamstown, Massachusetts, emailed as follows, "You and Charlie Pierce had some fun with one of the St. John's basketball recruits, the 6'9" forward from Nigeria with the unlikely name God's Gift Achuia. While I agree that this young man has an interesting name, you might want to consider that the common English names, Jonathan and Nathaniel, are both based on Hebrew names that mean, wait for it, God's gift. Maybe it isn't as unusual as you thought." Last week, we irked Carrie Seidman, who hears the program on WCPN in Cleveland. "You and Charlie Pierce referred to somebody named Jim Bottomley," Mr. Seidman wrote. "It figured that you two guys didn't have a clue to who he was. He didn't play in Boston. The Red Sox and Celtics do not define American sport, except in the mind of Mr. Pierce." Charles Hewitt, who hears the show on KWMU in St. Louis, wrote to say that he loves Only a Game, and he asked, "Do you have any eponymous baseball hats for sale? If there's more noise on behalf of those hats, I'll see what I can do." That would be with eponymous on the front, right? Finally, my notated copy of Lee Montville's book about Evel Knievel that we offered to somebody joining us on Facebook went to Laura Romains, who listens to the podcast in her home in the Netherlands. Congratulations, Laura. I don't know whether to hope you can read my handwriting or that you can't. You can follow us on Facebook and find us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio, and you can reach us through the website onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life, summer.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
The Goiânia State Championship semifinal soccer match between Brazilian teams Villanova and Goiás was interrupted for 20 minutes when a beehive was discovered on one of the crossbars at the stadium. Hundreds of bees swarmed at the top corner of the goal being defended by Pedro Henrique of Goiás, but the bees would not acknowledge that they had gathered to protect that corner of the goal from shots by Villanova. Apparently, to torture the bees into acknowledging their allegiance, the local fire brigade brought in a flaming torch. The bees fled, but admitted no wrongdoing. The game ended in a 2-2 draw and a brawl, which involved players from both teams and fans, but no bees. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Rex the Wonder Coach. No wonder I enjoyed my conversation with New York Jets mentor Rex Ryan. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce, with whom I enjoy a conversation about the week's news each week. Hello, Charlie. Nicely done. It is Derby Day, and you've got a score of horses, or actually one shy of a score of horses from which to pick. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the owners of Uncle Mo on behalf of those of us who will be watching on television for not running a horse that has a, quote, gastrointestinal problem, because that can't end well. You know who I'm going to pick, Bill? I'm going to pick the 30-1 shot Pants on Fire.
Oh, excellent.
No, not really. I just lied.
30-1.
No, I'm not really going to pick a horse called Pants on Fire. I just lied. Second time around for that joke, and he finally gets it. Now, I know nothing about any of these horses at all, so I'm just going to take my finger right here. See this one right here?
Yeah.
And I'm going to drop it on the list, and I've just picked Comma to the Top. But he's also 30-1. I think everyone's 30-1 in this race. Somebody's going to make a lot of money, and it's not going to be me.
This week, Derrick Rose became the NBA's youngest most valuable player. Is he valuable enough to lead the Chicago Bulls to a championship?
He's valuable enough, I think, to lead them to the NBA Finals. We'll see what he can do with whatever comes out of the Western Conference. Regardless of how good Miami looks right now, I think Chicago's the best team in the East.
I'm sure you were surprised to learn that the NBA Players Association is not pleased with the league's latest contract offer, Charlie. Commissioner Stern said this week he hopes the NBA can keep its dispute out of the courts because litigation is, quote, not appropriate to making a deal. Boy, I wish somebody'd thought about that on the NFL front.
Well, no, I mean, it's very easy to ask for things to stay out of the court when basically your position is, please accept everything we want and then we won't have to go to court.
Excellent. In the NHL Conference semifinals, Tampa Bay swept the Washington Capitals on Wednesday night. The Caps seem to be making a habit of flaming out of the playoffs earlier than people expect. Or are the Lightning just really good this year?
The Lightning are good, but the Washington Capitals are on their way to becoming the Vancouver Canucks of the East Coast. Both teams going in regularly as the top-seeded team in their conference and leaving the playoffs early. Of course, this year was the whole year that they had changed the Capitals around, and they got Alex Ovechkin to play within a team concept. You know what? I want the old Ovechkin back.
Wednesday night's game between the Los Angeles Angels and the Boston Red Sox produced some interesting statistics, I think. It ended at 2:45 a.m. after 23 hits and 433 pitches. Anaheim bullpen catcher Tom Gregorio was 33 when the game began. He was 34 when it ended. The teams met again for a day game on Thursday. I wonder if anybody suggested settling that second game with a coin flip.
Well, I think they should have probably established the slaughter rule that's familiar to those of us who have gone through the nightmare experience that is T-ball, because the Angels wound up beating the Red Sox 11-0, and the Red Sox did not look too enthusiastic about their work.
This week, Cleveland Indians outfielder Shin-Soo Choo became the sixth Major League Baseball player to be arrested for drunk driving in 2011. Both the league and the Players Association say they've been working on an alcohol policy to be included in the league's next collective bargaining agreement. Do you think that'll help?
Well, baseball's been looking for an alcohol policy for as long as there's been baseball, and usually the policy has been have some beer in the clubhouse and try not to kill anybody on the way home. The Shin-Soo Choo arrest, to me, is just a classic. He was arrested by a policeman who 10 minutes earlier he had asked for directions. And the second time he came up to the policeman said, "Guy really shouldn't ask me for directions twice in 10 minutes. Let's see what's up here." If it becomes another way for MLB to control the employees, I'm probably not in favor of it. But if they can find some sort of sensible education program regarding drinking and driving, that's probably the best they can do.
Speaking of new collective bargaining clauses, this year players are allowed to leave their teams for 24 to 72 hours for the birth of a child. It's Major League Baseball's first official paternity leave policy, and I understand not everybody thinks it's a good thing.
Well, yeah, Terry Collins, who likes to pretend he's Joan McGraw, has decided that you know, back in his day, nobody left the team to see their kids born, and they liked it.
I'm not sure who you were channeling there. I guess it was Joan McGraw. This year's National Football League draft was overshadowed somewhat by labor woes, of course, but is it fair to say the Cleveland Browns front office could have better maintained concentration during the late rounds of the draft?
How's this feel if you're a Cleveland Browns season ticket holder? They happen to be two players. One of them was named Cameron Jordan, and the other was named Jordan Cameron.
Uh-oh.
Long about the end of the draft, the Browns picked Jordan Cameron. Unfortunately, they called Cameron Jordan, who, having been celebrating for a while, was understandably a bit confused as to why the Browns were calling him, since he'd already been drafted by the Saints.
About 40 members of the New Orleans Saints worked out at Tulane University under the direction of quarterback Drew Brees this week, and New York Giants quarterback Eli Manning held a passing camp at a high school in Hoboken. I'm not sure I understand that. Eli and the Giants don't have enough pull to snag a college field?
I think it's probably it's a much better visual if you're at the high school field because you're connecting to the sport on the most basic level and so forth. The labor side in this controversy seems to be being led by the quarterbacks, which I find very interesting.
This week, France's sports minister said that the coach of the national soccer team is, quote, not a racist. This was after a recording was released of French soccer officials debating how to limit the number of black and Arab players on the national team. So How exactly is that not racist?
Well, I don't know, but it would be a lot helpful to Sports Minister Chantal Joanneau's case if she wasn't defending a national team coach named Blanc.
This is almost too easy sometimes, isn't
really,
it?
They write themselves. What can I tell you?
That's pop singer and Filipino congressman Manny Pacquiao. He said this week that he really likes to keep busy. So what's on his schedule for tonight?
Beating up Shane Mosley in the latest defense of the one of the 58 world championships that he holds. Listen to him, though. He sounds like a uniquely sensitive Edward Bear. You know? Except I think he's a lot tougher than Edward Bear was.
And finally, Charlie, the governor of Georgia has come up with a new plan to satisfy tourists who come to Augusta hoping to see the exclusive grounds of the Augusta National Golf Club. No, you still can't get inside the gates to play a round of golf, but you will soon be able to drive a golf cart around downtown Augusta, so that's just as good, right?
That's terrific. You can drive a golf cart around downtown Augusta, but you still can't drive them during a PGA tournament. And wasn't it George Jones who once rode a riding lawnmower to the liquor store?
Yes,
this is asking for nothing but trouble.
Charlie Fierce is the author of Idiot America and several other books. He joins me in Only a Game each week, of course, at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
In Play Like You Mean It, an autobiography written with the assistance of former Sports Illustrated associate editor Don Yeager, New York Jets head coach Rex Ryan discusses, among other things, his coaching philosophy, his dyslexia, and the criticism he received for his language as exposed on the HBO sports program Hard Knocks. Rex Ryan joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Coach, welcome to Only a Game.
It's nice to be here.
Your father, Buddy Ryan, earned great respect as a coach in the National Football League. He was celebrated as an innovator, certainly. Did you ever consider not entering the same career that your dad had been so successful in?
You know what? That never occurred to me, that I always wanted to be a coach. And I think the big reason I really wanted to be a coach was because I would see my dad. He would go to work, and he literally could not wait to get to work. And he was so excited about the next week's game. Even if they lost, he couldn't wait to get around his players. And he loved his job. And I think that was something that I saw. And it wasn't just me seeing it. My twin brother got in the same profession. So I think we both saw that.
See, I could see how it might work the other way. With anybody working in a pro sport, a coach or a manager, he'd be away from home so much of the time, mm-hmm. and studying film and, you know, working to try and get that one more thing going right in the team, that families sometimes can really suffer under those circumstances. I would think a kid might say, boy, the one thing I don't want to be is a head coach in the NFL.
You know what? That's probably a true statement. It is tough. It is tough on families. My folks were divorced when I was young and things, but there's two kind of coaches' wives, great ones and ex-ones. And and I'm fortunate. I've been married for 24 years, but this is definitely not easy on families, that's for sure. But the life, I've never had a bad job in my life, ever, no matter where I coached. And I coached 8 years of small college football. You know, not exactly the most glamorous places of all time, but I enjoyed every one of my jobs that I ever had.
You have been among the most outspoken NFL head coaches. Has this been part of an effort to take the media attention off your players by getting the cameras to focus on you?
You know, at times that's true. For instance, we're playing New England in the playoffs, and we had just been thumped by New England 6 weeks prior. I never wanted it to be about everybody talking about how we got beat, 45-3. Why did you get beat 45-3? All that kind of stuff. So instead, I challenged Bill Belichick that I thought the game would come down to his coaching versus my coaching. It was going to be directly on me, and that was it. And then at the end of the game, we found a way to win the game. And I told everybody then that, hey, look, yeah, I was dead wrong. It had nothing to do with my coaching versus Bill's because, quite honestly, we would have lost that matchup. You know, he's the best coach maybe in the history of this sport. So did I do it on purpose? Yeah, I did it on purpose.
Speaking of the relationship between you and Coach Belichick, and by extension between the Jets and the Patriots, people up here like to talk about how you say that you hate Tom Brady, but I thought the book explained that rather humorously. Tell us a little about that.
Well, that's it. I'm always trying to tweak him because look at this guy. I mean, you look at his life. He's got 3 Super Bowl championship rings. He's married to one of the most beautiful women in the world. He's got kids. He's a tall, handsome man and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I hate him, you know, but it's not a hate. It's an admiration for him. But I do like to tweak him. And you'll notice, really, if I ever do that, it's with the great ones. You know, it's with Tom Brady. It's with Peyton Manning. Those are the guys that I'll try to stir it up with. But I have a great deal of respect for really all the players that play this game and the coaches that coach it.
You signed off on the Jets being featured on Hard Knocks, which filmed you during team meetings and other places as well. And you've said that getting the Jets in the paper or on TV is good, whatever the context. But having been criticized for your use of profanity during that program, have you had any second thoughts about cooperating with Hard Knocks?
No, not at all. And I think, you know, number one, I'll do 1,000 interviews, you know, during a season. It's funny, that's probably not an exaggeration. But I never cuss, I never use foul language in any interview. But in that, those are team settings. And I told our team, I said, we're going to be ourselves. I thought it was strange that I was criticized the way I was. You know, like for Tony Dungy, for instance, a guy that I really respect and admire, I was shocked that he would judge me as I looked at it. You know, I'm just an average person, you know, with an incredible opportunity to coach this team. But I'll be darned if I coach it anybody else's way. I may have one shot in my life to be a head coach in this league, and I'm not going to do it somebody else's way. I'm going to do it my way.
Of course, you may not get a chance to do things your way in the fall. If the league and the players don't iron out their differences, next season may not happen. Has the on-again, off-again lockout been frustrating for you as a head coach?
Well, you know, first off, I don't believe that we're going to lose any games. I think we're going to play football, and I really believe strongly in that. And the reason I say that is that, number one, I know ownership wants to have a football season. I know the players want to play a football season. I know our fans want to see a football season. So those 3 factors, I think, will drive this to getting done. And hopefully we can put all this behind us, and there'll be a great deal, and everybody will get back to playing football. But I really believe that we're going to play football.
It's a sunny kind of view that you have. The players want to play, the owners want to play, the fans want to see the game. But if that were really strictly true, we wouldn't be in this mess, right?
Well, I think, you know, you have guys, you know, trying to make the game better. You know, they have strong opinions about things. Certainly guys with a lot more, you know, on the ball than me. I'm just a football coach. So, you know, guys that are with a higher pay grade than I have and much smarter about it than me are negotiating these things. But I just think those basic fundamentals are going to bring football to us.
In the book, Don Yeager represents you as saying, and I'm quoting now, make a statement, knock the snot out of somebody, and you intimidate with big, vicious hits. Have the recent revelations about brain damage among former NFL players caused you to rethink that approach at all?
No, I tell you why, because we do things within the confinements of the rules, and I appreciate the fact that we have rules that our league is looking into protecting our players. I think that's the greatest thing there is. But if you take away the hitting in this league, you don't have near the sport. You know, this is a sport that still takes courage to play, and I think that's part of the beauty of football. And, you know, obviously the rules are changed now to protect the players. You know, it's not like the old days where you can flash, you know, how many fingers up, and then you throw a guy back in there. There's a number of tests that the young men have to pass before ever getting the green light to go back out there. So it's quite a process, something that, you know, back in the day, I remember, you know, I got knocked out, you know, had a concussion the very next week. Boy, you're right back in there, you know. So it's a lot different now than it was several years ago. That's for sure, and that's a great thing.
Do you worry at all about your own health?
No, I mean, I've been good. I worried about a little bit. I think I've dropped like 60 pounds with this lap band surgery. And quite honestly, it's something that I've even thought about calling Commissioner Goodell about. Is we're doing a great job with the concussions and things like that, follow-ups to those things. But, you know, how about the great big offensive linemen, defensive linemen, the sleep apnea, diabetes, and all that kind of stuff associated with being heavy and being morbidly obese? If we can take that away, you know, maybe that this lap band, you know, might be good for others as well.
You better be careful about getting so slender and good looking. You'll have no reason to hate Tom Brady.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Oh, man. Rex Ryan is the head coach of the New York Jets. He and Don Yeager have recently collaborated on Play Like You Mean It, Passion, Laughs, and Leadership in the World's Most Beautiful Game. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Coach Ryan, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Mark Filippino. We had help this week from Peter Lydodes. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Ken Schulman's Ferrari World photo gallery or Kim Green's Predators picks or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Rex Ryan, who comments on his general health.
My doctors would always tell me, man, you look good on paper. I'm like, oh, I appreciate that, you know.
Yeah, Tom Brady's doc tells him he looks pretty good, too. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting Games for Health, working to use video games to improve health at rwjf.org/pioneer. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.